From NPR and WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and we want to go right to the mall in Washington where B.B. and Carvin Winans of the Winans singing family are just wrapping up. You know, he's asking the crowd for a note. Here they come.
He's got the whole world in his hands. 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 He's got you and me, brother, in his hands. He's got you and me, brother, in his hands. He's got you and me, brother, in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands.
You and me, sister, in his hands.
We have been hearing music and speeches for the last several hours from Washington, and we want to welcome one of our guests who's been helping us navigate not just what we're hearing today from Washington, but what it meant 50 years ago. Peniel Joseph is a founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and professor of history at Tufts University. Peniel, hello.
Hello, Robin.
And what are your thoughts so far on what you've been hearing from Washington, especially for listeners who may be just joining us?
Well, I think it's continuing this national conversation that we're having about race and democracy, especially this year on the 50th anniversary. This has been a year whether we're talking about the Supreme Court's voting rights decision, Trayvon Martin, there's Eric Holder's speech about criminal justice a couple of weeks ago, where race has really been part of the national conversation again. And all these speeches have talked about what we need to do, how we need to move forward in the 21st century, that Barack Obama and that victory is not enough.
We're also joined, Robin, right now by Margaret Burnham, who went to the march when she was 19 back in 63. She's currently a Northeastern law professor. Margaret, your thoughts on today's significance?
Well, I really appreciate the look forward and the consideration of what the march means for the future. What I would like to see is a little bit more retrospective consideration of how the march came to be. It's almost as if out of nowhere 250,000 people arrived on the Washington Mall and heard Dr. Martin Luther King, when in fact the March on Washington movement had its beginnings back in 1941 when A. Philip Randolph first approached President Roosevelt to ask him whether it wasn't time to desegregate the military industries that were gearing up for World War II. And the president rebuffed him and turned him back, and A. Philip Randolph said, well, let's see if we can't gather more support for this claim, and we'll bring hundreds of thousands of Negroes to Washington so that you can hear our voices. And at that point, FDR did back down, and he said, well, yes, he passed the Fair Employment Practices Act, which was the Fair Employment Practices Commission. By executive order, established that. And that began the March on Washington movement. So the 1963 march has a long and deep history. It didn't appear from nowhere. It was originally A. Philip Randolph's idea. For my own participation, as a college student, I worked with Bayard Rustin in a small office in Harlem, which was the headquarters for the march on 130th Street in Harlem. It was gut work. It was preparing literature and distributing literature and sort of canvassing all across the Harlem neighborhoods to get people out for the march.
And you mentioned Bayard Rustin. Let's just stop there for a second, Margaret, or I should say both Professor and Judge Burnham. You were the first African-American female judge in Massachusetts. Bayard Rustin, some say another unsung name from the march, and others have said the organizer, along with A. Philip Randolph.
Absolutely the organizer of the march. Certainly it began with A. Philip Randolph's idea that we needed to have our bodies in Washington, but carrying that idea to fruition was really the strategist Bayard Rustin, who had long been involved in civil rights and civil resistance from the early 1940s, and this was really the pinnacle of his own career as an organizer. It was he who navigated between the big, first the Big Six and then the Big Ten, the men who planned the march, and the grassroots participants who ultimately showed up in Washington. It was he who pulled together labor and made sure that there were reliable links between labor and civil rights and church and church and civic organizations. He was really the strategist behind the march, while others negotiated, of course, with Washington. He was the one who put bodies in the buses and the trains and got us all there to Washington and made it happen.
Professor Bernan, again, of Northeastern, but also someone who 50 years ago was on the Mall in Washington, helping as a young student, helping the organizers there. We are listening, and let's listen now as a speaker comes out. She's none other than Oprah.
Thrilled to be here. I remember when I was 9 years old and the march was occurring, and I asked my mama, can I go to the march? Took me 50 years, but I'm here. On this date, in this place, at this time, 50 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King shared his dream for America with America. Dr. King was the passionate voice that awakened the conscience of a nation and inspired people all over the world. The power of his words resonated because they were spoken out of an unwavering belief in freedom and justice, equality, and opportunity for all. Let freedom ring was Dr. King's closing call for a better and more just America. So today, people from all walks of life will gather at 3 p.m. for bell-ringing events across our great country and around the world as we reaffirm our commitment to Dr. King's ideals. Dr. King believed that our destinies are all intertwined, and he knew that our hopes and our dreams are really all the same. He challenged us to see how we all are more alike than we are different. So as the bells of freedom ring today, we're hoping that it's a time for all of us to reflect on not only the progress that has been made, and we've made a lot, but on what we have accomplished and also on the work that still remains before us. It's an opportunity today to recall where we once were in this nation, and to think about that young man who at 34 years old stood up here and was able to force an entire country to wake up, to look at itself, and to eventually change. And as we, the people, continue to honor the dream of a man and a movement, a man who in his short life saw suffering and injustice and refused to look the other way, we can be inspired, and we too can be courageous by continuing to walk in the footsteps of the path that he forged. He's the one who reminded us that we will never walk alone. He was, after all, a drum major for justice. So as the bells toll today, let us reflect on the bravery, let us reflect on the sacrifice of those who stood up for freedom, who stood up for us, whose shoulders we now stand on. And as the bells toll today at 3, let us ask ourselves, how will the dream live on in me, in you, in all of us? As the bells toll, let us remind ourselves injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. As the bells toll, we commit to a life of service, because Dr. King, one of my favorite quotes from him is, not everybody can be famous, but everybody can be great, because greatness is determined by service. So we ask ourselves, what are we doing for others to lift others up? And as the bells toll, we must recommit to that the love that abides and connects each of us to shine through and let freedom ring.
Oprah Winfrey speaking at the National Mall in Washington on this 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Yeah, we're still looking forward to members of the King family coming out. John Lewis coming out as well. Margaret Burnham, until he does, just your thoughts quickly on Oprah's, the symbol of her, when 50 years ago, women were not allowed to speak, or few of them were.
Very few, very few. It was really the Big Ten who were the major speakers there. I did hear the Gloria Richardson's report, and that was a piece of history I hadn't known about. But back then, obviously, we had a different consciousness about where women should be and how loud their voices should be, and how and when and when they when and where they should speak.
And Judge Burnham, we have. I don't mean to cut yours off now, but we have.
Right.
We have John Lewis coming to the podium. He, of course, the only speaker from 1963, major speaker from 1963, still alive. He's getting huge applause. Let's listen in. Oh, I thought we saw him. Signs are being held up. Thank you, Congressman John Lewis. A young white man holding up that
sign. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President Jimmy Carter.
All right.
President Bill Clinton.
What they're doing is they're bringing people to the podium. So as they do bring guests like John Lewis, who just came out, and President Carter, who is being brought out to sit on the podium, we turn again to Peniel. Your thoughts about what you're hearing here.
Well, I think what Oprah said is great, but it's important for us to remember that the way in which this march came about in 63 was because of the grassroots activism of so many ordinary Americans. One highlight is somebody like Ella Baker, who helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And Ella Baker was an NAACP activist. She was a labor activist. And she told the young people after the sit-in movements that erupted February 1st, 1960, that strong people didn't need strong leaders.
Peniela, as we watch President Obama and Michelle Obama, as well as the two former presidents, President Clinton and President Carter, coming out onto the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, let me ask how you feel that young people have picked up the mantle. Caroline Kennedy spoke in the last hour and said each generation must rededicate itself to building a free and just America.
Well, I think contemporary young people are well
Ladies
aware of
and
this.
Gentlemen,
and I think
please
that
stand for our national
when we think about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, this was a young people's movement.
And let's listen now to the national anthem.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
Identity for Pop is the name of the group there singing the Star Spangled Banner. This is special
Ladies
coverage from NPR and
John
WBUR
Lewis.
Boston. And let's go right to John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, who was, as Robin said, there, spoke at the original march in 1963.
President and Mrs. Obama, President Clinton, President Carter, I want to thank Bernice King, the King family, and the National Park Service for inviting me here to speak today. When I look out over this diverse crowd and survey the guests on this platform, it seemed to realize what Otis Redding sang about and what Martin Luther King Jr. preached about. This moment in our history has been a long time coming, but a change has come. We are standing here in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln, 150 years after he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and only 50 years after the historic March on Washington for jobs and freedom. We have come a great distance in this country in the 50 years, but we still have a great distance to go before we fulfill the dream of Martin Luther King Jr. Sometimes I hear people saying nothing has changed, but for someone to grow up the way I grew up in the cotton fields of Alabama, to now be serving in the United States Congress, makes me want to tell them, come and walk in my shoes. Come walk in the shoes of those who were attacked by police dogs, fire hoses, and nightsticks, arrested and taken to jail. I first came to Washington in the same year that President Barack Obama was born to participate in the Freedom Ride. In 1961, black and white people could not be seated together on a Greyhound bus. So we decided to take an integrated fashion ride from here to New Orleans. But we never made it there. Over 400 of us were arrested and jailed in Mississippi during the Freedom Ride. A bus was set on fire in Anniston, Alabama. We were beaten and arrested and jailed, but we helped bring an end to segregation in public transportation. I came back here again in June of 1963 with the Big Six as the new chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We met with President Kennedy, who said the fires of frustration were burning throughout America. In 1963, we could not register to vote simply because of the color of our skin. We had to pay a poll tax, pass a so-called literacy test, count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap, or the number of jelly beans in a jar. Hundreds and thousands of people were arrested and jailed throughout the South for trying to participate in the democratic process. Mega Evers had been killed in Mississippi, and that's why we told President Kennedy we intended to march on Washington to demonstrate the need for equal justice and equal opportunity in America. On August 28, 1963, the nation's capital was in a state of emergency. Thousands of troops surrounded the city. Workers was told to stay home that day. Liquor stores were closed. But the march was so orderly, so peaceful. It was filled with dignity and self-respect. Because we believe in the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. People came that day to that march dressed like they were on their way to a religious service. As Mahalia Jackson sang, how we got over, how we got over. She drew thousands of us together in a strange sense. It seemed like the whole place started rocking. We truly believe that in every human being, Even those who violent, who were violent toward us, there was a spark of the divine. And no person had the right to scar or destroy that spark. Martin Luther King Jr. taught us the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. He taught us to have the power to forgive, the capacity to be reconciled. He taught us to stand up, to speak up, to speak out, to find a way to get in the way. People were inspired by that vision of justice and equality, and they were willing to put their bodies on the line for a greater cause, greater than themselves. Not one incident of violence was reported that day. A spirit had engulfed the leadership of the movement and all of its participants. The spirit of Dr. King's words captured the hearts of people not just around America, but around the world. On that day, Martin Luther King Jr. made a speech, but he also delivered a sermon. He transformed these marble steps of the Lincoln Memorial into a modern-day pulpit. He changed us forever. After the ceremony was over, President Kennedy invited us back down to the White House. He met us standing in the door of the Oval Office, and he was beaming like a proud father. As he shook the hands of each one of us, he said, "You did a good job. You did a good job." And he said to Dr. King, "And you had a dream." 50 years later, we can ride anywhere we want to ride. We can stay where we want to stay. Those signs that said white and colored are gone. And you won't see them anymore. Except in a museum, in a book, on a video. But there's still invisible signs, barriers in the hearts of humankind that form a gulf between us. Too many of us still believe our differences define us instead of the divine spark that runs through all of human creation. The scars and stains of racism still remain deeply embedded in American society. Whether it is stop and frisk in New York or injustice in the Trayvon Martin case in Florida, the mass incarceration of millions of Americans, immigrants hiding in fear in the shadow of our society, unemployment, homelessness, poverty, hunger, or the renewed struggle for voting rights. So I said to each one of us today, we must never, ever give up. We must never, ever give in. We must keep the faith and keep our eyes on the prize. We did go to jail, but we got a Civil Rights Act. We got a Voting Rights Act. We got a Fair Housing Act. But we must continue to push. We must continue to work. As the late A. Philip Randolph said, the organizer of the march in 1963, and the dean of the Civil Rights Movement once said, "We may have come here on different ships, but we all are in the same boat now." So it doesn't matter whether we're black or white, Latinos, Asian American or Native American, whether we are gay or straight, we are one people, we are one family, we all live in the same house, not just American house, but the world house. And when we finally accept these truths, then we will be able to fulfill Dr. King's dream to build a beloved community, a nation and a world at peace with itself, Thank you very much.
This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. You were just listening to the remarks of Representative John Lewis. Here's President Carter.
Jimmy Carter.
Well, I'm greatly honored to be here. And I realize that most people know that it's highly unlikely that any of us three over on my right would have served in the White House or be on this platform had it not been for Martin Luther King Jr. and his movement and his crusade for civil rights. So we are grateful to him for us being here. I'm also proud that I came from the same part of the South as he did. He never lost contact with the folks back home. He was helping Tennessee garbage workers, as you know, when he gave his life to a racist bullet. I remember how it was back in those days. I left Georgia in 1943 for college and the Navy. And when I came home from submarine duty, I was put on the Board of Education. I suggested to the other members that we visit all the schools in the county. They had never done this before, and they were reluctant to go with me. But we finally did it, and we found that white children had three nice brick buildings. But the African-American children had 26 different elementary schools in the county. They were in churches, in front living rooms, and a few were in barns. They had so many because there were no school buses for African-American children, and they had to be within walking distance of where they went to class. Their school books were outdated and worn out, and every one of them had a white child's name in the front of the book. We finally obtained some buses, and then the state legislature ordained that the front fenders be painted black. Not even the school buses could be equal to each other. One of the finest moments of my life was 10 months after Dr. King's famous speech right here, when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. I was really grateful when the King family adopted me as their presidential candidate in 1976. Every handshake from Dr. King, from Daddy King, every hug from Coretta got me a million Yankee votes. Daddy King prayed at the Democratic Convention for quite a while, I might say. And Coretta was in the hotel room with me and Rosalind when I was elected president. My Presidential Medal of Freedom citation to Coretta for Dr. King said, and I quote, "He gazed at the Great Wall of Segregation and saw that the power of love could bring it down. He made our nation stronger because he made it better." We were able to create a national historic site where Dr. King lived, worked, and worshiped. It's next door to the Carter Center, linked together just by a walking path. And at the Carter Center, we try to make the principles that we follow the same as his, emphasizing peace and human rights. I remember that Daddy King said, "Too many people think Martin freed only black people. In truth, he helped to free all people." And Daddy King added, "It's not enough to have a right to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a meal." And he also said, "The ghetto still looks the same even from the front seat of a bus." Perhaps the most challenging statement of Martin Luther King Jr. was, and I quote, "The crucial question of our time is how to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to oppression and violence." In the Nobel Prize ceremony of 2002, I said that my fellow Georgian was, and I quote again, the greatest leader that my native state and perhaps my native country has ever produced. And I was not excluding presidents and even the founding fathers when I said this. I believe we all know how Dr. King would have reacted to the new ID requirements to exclude certain voters, especially African Americans. I think we all know how Dr. King would have reacted to the Supreme Court striking down a crucial part of the Voters' Rights Act just recently passed overwhelmingly by Congress. I think we all know how Dr. King would have reacted to unemployment among African Americans being almost twice the rate of white people, and for teenagers at 42%. I think we would all know how Dr. King would have reacted to our country being awash in guns, and for more and more states passing stand your ground laws. I think we know how Dr. King would have reacted for people of District of Columbia still not having full citizenship rights. And I think we all know how Dr. King would have reacted to have more than 835,000 African-American men in prison, five times as many as when I left office, and with one-third of all African-American males being destined to be in prison in their lifetimes. Well, there's a tremendous agenda ahead of us, and I'm thankful to Martin Luther King Jr. that his dream is still alive. Thank you.
Former President Jimmy Carter, you're listening to special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Now let's listen to President Clinton.
Thank you. Mr. President, Mrs. Obama, President Carter, Vice President Biden, Dr. Biden, I want to thank my great friend, Reverend Bernice King, and the King family for inviting me to be a part of this 50th observation of one of the most important days in American history. Dr. King and A. Philip Randolph, John Lewis and Bayard Rustin, Dorothy Hite, Merle Evers, Daisy Bates, and all the others who led this massive march knew what they were doing on this hallowed ground. In the shadow of Lincoln's statue, the burning memory of the fact that he gave his life to preserve the Union and end slavery, Martin Luther King urged his crowd not to drink from the cup of bitterness, but to reach across the racial divide. Because, he said, we cannot walk alone. Their destiny is tied up with our destiny. Their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. He urged the victims of racial violence to meet white Americans with an outstretched hand, not a clenched fist, and in so doing to prove the redeeming power of unearned suffering. And then he dreamed of an America where all citizens would sit together at the table of brotherhood, where little white boys and girls and little black boys and girls would hold hands across the color line, where his own children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. This march and that speech changed America. They opened minds, they melted hearts, and they moved millions, including a 17-year-old boy watching alone in his home in Arkansas. It was an empowering moment, but also an empowered moment. As the great chronicler of those years, Taylor Branch, wrote, "The movement here gained the force to open, quote, the stubborn gates of freedom and out flowed the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, immigration reform, Medicare, Medicaid, open housing. It is well to remember that the leaders and the foot soldiers here were both idealists and tough realists. They had to be. It was a violent time. Just 3 months later, we lost President Kennedy. And we thank God that President Johnson came in and fought for all those issues I just mentioned. Just 5 years later, we lost Senator Kennedy. And in between, there was the carnage of the fight for jobs, freedom, and equality. Just 18 days after this march, four little children were killed in the Birmingham church bombing. Then there were the Ku Klux Klan murders, the Mississippi lynching, and a dozen others, until in 1968, Dr. King himself was martyred, still marching for jobs and freedom. What a debt we owe to those people who came here 50 years ago. The martyrs played it all for a dream. A dream, as John Lewis said, that millions have now actually lived. So how are we going to repay the debt? Dr. King's dream of interdependence, his prescription of wholehearted cooperation across racial lines, they ring as true today as they did 50 years ago. Oh, yes, we face terrible political gridlock now. Read a little history. It's nothing new. Yes, there remain racial inequalities in employment, income, health, wealth, incarceration, and in the victims and perpetrators of violent crime. But we don't face beatings, lynchings, and shootings for our political beliefs anymore. And I would respectfully suggest that Martin Luther King did not live and die to hear his heirs whine about political gridlock. It is time to stop complaining and put our shoulders against the stubborn gates holding the American people back. We cannot be disheartened by the forces of resistance to building a modern economy of good jobs and rising incomes, or to rebuilding our education system to give all our children a common core of knowledge necessary to ensure success, or to give Americans of all ages access to affordable college and training programs. And we thank the President for his efforts in those regards. We cannot relax in our efforts to implement health care reform in a way that ends discrimination against those with pre-existing conditions, one of which is inadequate income to pay for rising health care. A health care reform that will lower costs and lengthen lives. Nor can we use technology to train our young people of all races for the jobs of tomorrow and to act on what we learn about our bodies, our businesses, and our climate. We must push open those stubborn gates. We cannot be discouraged by a Supreme Court decision that said we don't need this critical provision of the Voting Rights Act because look at the states. It made it harder for African Americans and Hispanics and students and the elderly and the infirm and poor working folks to vote. What do you know? They showed up, stood in line for hours, and voted anyway. So obviously we don't need any kind of law. But a great democracy does not make it harder to vote than to buy an assault weapon. We must open those stubborn gates. And let us not forget that while racial divides persist and must not be denied, the whole American landscape is littered with the lost dreams and dashed hopes of people of all races. And the great irony of the current moment is that the future has never brimmed with more possibilities. It has never burned brighter in what we could become if we push open those stubborn gates and if we do it together. The choice remains as it was on that distant summer day 50 years ago. Cooperate and thrive, or fight with each other and fall behind. We should all thank God for Dr. King and John Lewis and all those who gave us a dream to guide us, a dream they paid for like our founders with their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor. And we thank them for reminding us that America is always becoming, always on a journey. And we all, every single citizen among us, have to run our lap. God bless them, and God bless America.
Former President Bill Clinton speaking at the 50th anniversary celebration of the March on Washington and the National Mall. This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston.
And they were scheduled to have a singer here, but we can hear that they are going to the King family. Let's
Mr. listen. President, Madam First Lady, President Carter, President Clinton, Congressman Lewis, and to all program participants, this is an unusual moment in our
Martin
world
Luther King
history.
III.
As we observe this 50th anniversary.
Martin Luther King III.
And I am so thankful for the opportunity to really thank America for helping to realize the dream, although I must say it is not yet realized. And so we must redouble and quadruple our efforts. So much has been said today, and I was 5 years old in 1963 when Dad delivered his message. And so I'm blessed that we were able to bring our daughter, who's hopefully paying attention, five years old, so that she can appreciate this history and continue to participate. There are two quick other things that I want to say. I've been speaking all week, as many of us have. But I'm reminded that Dad challenged us. That's what he did, challenged our nation to be a better nation for all God's children. I'm reminded that he taught us the power of love, agape love. The love that is totally unselfish. You love someone if they're old or young, rich or poor, black or white, Native American or Hispanic American or Latino. It does not matter. You love them because God calls us to do that. Love and forgiveness is what we need more of, not just in our nation, but really throughout the world. And so I want to rush to tell you, Dad said the ultimate measure of a human being is where one stands, not in times of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy. He went on to say that on some questions, cowardice asks, is a position safe? Expediency ask is a position politic. Vanity ask is a position popular. But that something deep inside called conscience ask is a position right. So he often talked about sometimes we must take positions that are neither safe nor popular nor politic. But we must take those positions because our conscience tells us they're right. I finally say this afternoon, we've got a lot of work to do, but none of us should be any ways tired. Why? Because we've come much too far from where we started. You see, no one ever told any of us that our roads would be easy, but I know our God did not bring any of us this far to leave us. Thank you. God bless you.
I definitely agree.
Martin Luther King III.
Please welcome Christine King Ferris.
We'll be hearing from different members of the King family up until the hour.
Thank you, President Obama and Mrs. Obama, former Presidents Clinton and Carter, other distinguished program participants. I am honored to be among you today and to address this historic gathering. I don't know if I am the most senior speaker to address this assembly today, but I am certainly and surely the only person alive who knew Martin Luther King Jr. when he was a baby. It has been my great privilege to watch my little brother grow and thrive and develop into a fine man and then a great leader whose legacy continues to inspire countless millions around the world. Unfortunately, a bout with a flu virus 50 years ago prevented me from attending the original march, but I was able to watch it on television, and I was as awestruck as everyone else. I knew Martin was an excellent preacher because I had seen him deliver on many occasions, but on that day, Martin achieved greatness because he melded the hopes and dreams of millions into a grand vision of healing, reconciliation, and brotherhood. The dream my brother shared with our nation and world on that sweltering day of days 50 years ago continues to nurture and sustain nonviolent activists worldwide in their struggles for freedom and human rights. Indeed, this gathering provides a powerful testament of hope and proof positive that Martin's great dream will live on in the heart of humanity for generations to come. Our challenge then, as followers of Martin Luther King Jr., is to now honor his life, leadership, and legacy by living our lives in a way that carries forward the unfinished work. There is no better way to honor his sacrifices and contributions than by becoming champions of nonviolence in our homes and communities, in our places of work, worship, and learning, everywhere, every day. The dream Martin shared on that day a half century ago remains a definitive statement of the American dream, the beautiful vision of a diverse, freedom-loving people, united in our love for justice, brotherhood, and sisterhood. Yes, they can slay the dreamer, but no, they cannot destroy his immortal dream. But Martin's dream is a vision not yet to be realized, a dream yet unfilled, and we have much to do before we can celebrate the dream as a reality, as the suppression of voting rights and horrific violence that has taken the lives of Trayvon Martin and young people all across America has so painfully demonstrated. But despite the influences and challenges we face, we are here today to affirm the dream We are not going to be discouraged. We are not going to be distracted. We are not going to be defeated. Instead, we are going forward into this uncertain future with courage and determination to make the dream a vibrant reality. And so the work to fulfill the dream goes on, and despite the daunting challenges we face on the road to the beloved community, I feel that the dream is sinking deep and nourishing roots all across America and around the world. May it continue to thrive and spread and help bring justice, peace, and liberation to all humanity. Thank you, and God bless you all.
Christine King Ferris, the only sibling of Martin Luther King, speaking there. And by the way, Robin, wearing
Please
an incredible hat.
Reverend
yes, something.
Bernice
Black
King.
And white and feathered.
Now we're going to hear from the youngest child of Dr. King.
President Obama, Mrs. Obama, Presidents Carter and Clinton, Congressman Lewis, Ambassador Young, to my brother Martin III, Dexter Scott King, and to my entire family. I was 5 months old when my father delivered his I Have a Dream speech, and I probably was somewhere crawling on the floor or taking a nap after having a meal. But today is a glorious day because on this program today we have witnessed a manifestation of the beloved community. And we thank everyone for their presence here today. Today, we have been honored to have three presidents of the United States. 50 years ago, the president did not attend. Today, we are honored to have many women in the planning and mobilization of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And 50 years ago, there was not a single woman on the program. Today, we are honored to have not just one young person, but several young people on the program today. It is certainly a tribute to the work and the legacy of so many people that have gone on before us. 50 years ago today, in the symbolic shadow of this great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, my father, the great liberator, stood in this very spot and declared to this nation his dream to let freedom ring for all people who were being manacled by a system of segregation and discrimination. 50 years ago, he commissioned us to go back to our various cities, towns, hamlets, states, and villages and let freedom ring. The reverberation of the sound of that freedom message has amplified and echoed since 1963 through the decades and coast to coast throughout this nation and even around the world, and has summoned us once again back to these hallowed grounds to send out a clarion call to let freedom ring. Since that time, as a result of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act in 1968, we have witnessed great strides toward freedom for all, regardless of race, color, gender, religion, national origin, disability, class, or sexual orientation. 50 years later, in this year of Jubilee, we're standing once again in the shadow of that great emancipator, having been summoned to these hallowed grounds to reverberate the message of that great liberator. For there's a remnant from 1963, Congressman Lewis, Ambassador Young, that still remains, who has come to bequeath that message of freedom to a new generation of people who must now carry that message in their time, in their communities, amongst their tribes, and amongst their nations of the world. We must keep the sound and the message of freedom and justice going. It was my mother, as has been said previously, Coretta Scott King, who in fact 30 years ago assembled a coalition of conscience that started us on this whole path of remembering the anniversary of the March on Washington. She reminded us that struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation. And so we come once again to let freedom ring, because if freedom stops ringing, then the sound will disappear and the atmosphere will be charged with something else. 50 years later, we come once again to this special landing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to reflect, to renew, and to rejuvenate for the continued struggle of freedom and justice. For today, 50 years later, my friends, we are still crippled by practices and policies steeped in racial pride, hatred, and hostility, some of which have us standing our ground rather than finding common ground. We are still chained by economic disparities, income and class inequalities, and conditions of poverty for many of God's children around this nation and the world. We're still bound by a cycle of civil unrest and inherent social biases in our nation and world that oftentimes degenerates into violence and destruction, especially against women and children. We're at this landing, and now we must break the cycle. The prophet King spoke the vision. He made it plain, and we must run with it in this generation. His prophetic vision and magnificent dream describe the yearning of people all over the world to have the freedom to prosper in life, which is the right to pursue one's aspirations, purpose, dreams, well-being, without oppressive, depressive, repressive practices, behaviors, laws, and conditions that diminish one's dignity and that denies one life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The freedom to participate in government, which is the right to have a voice and a say in how you are represented, regulated, and governed without threats of tyranny, disenfranchisement, exclusionary tactics, and behaviors. And to have freedom to peacefully coexist, which is the right to be respected in one's selfhood, individuality, and uniqueness without fear of attack, assault, or abuse. In 1967, my father asked a poignant and critical question: where do we go from here, chaos or community? And we say with a resounding voice, no to chaos and yes to community. If we're going to rid ourselves of the chaos, then we must make a necessary shift. Nothing is more tragic than for us to fail to achieve new attitudes and new mental outlooks. We have a tremendous and unprecedented opportunity to reset the very means by which we live, work, and enjoy our lives. If we're going to continue the struggle of freedom and create true community, then we will have to be relentless in exposing, confronting, and ridding ourselves of the mindset of pride and greed and selfishness and hate and lust and fear and idleness and lack of purpose and lack of love, as my brother said, for our neighbor. We must seize this moment, the dawning of a new day, the emergence of a new generation who is postured to change the world through collaborative power facilitated by unconditional love. And as I close, I call upon a brother by the name of Nehemiah, who was also in the midst of rebuilding a community. And in the midst of rebuilding a community, he brought the leaders and the rulers and the rest of the people together. And he told them that the work is great and large and we are widely separated one from another on the wall. But when you hear the sound of the trumpet, and might I say, when you hear the sound of the bell today, come to that spot and our God will fight with us. And so today we're gonna let freedom ring all across this nation. We're gonna let freedom ring everywhere we go. If freedom is going to ring in Libya, in Syria, in Egypt, in Florida, then we must reach across the table, feed each other, and let freedom ring.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston of the observation of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. You just heard the Reverend Dr. Bernice King, one of the organizers of today's events. And now we see other participants, including President Obama, President Clinton, President Carter, Oprah, approaching.
In 1963, the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed. The bell was saved. And thanks to the church and William Bell, the mayor of Birmingham, that bell is here. To help celebrate Dr. King's legacy and this day, let freedom ring.
Each of the participants ringing the bell, a child being lifted. Bells are scheduled to ring in around 50 other communities across the country, echoing the words spoken by Martin Luther King Jr. on this day 50 years ago. Bells are ringing on Stone Mountain in Georgia.
Please welcome our next
Mountain,
performance
Tennessee.
By Tony and Grammy Award winner Heather Headley.
We have the music of Heather Headley, and we are anticipating the President of the United States.
That's right. We're waiting for that. And, Robin, 300 sites in nearly every state will ring their bell now as Bernice King, the daughter of Martin Luther King, just said, let freedom ring. This is special coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Jeremy Hobson here along with Robin Young and a cast of others to help us celebrate this.
In fact, let's go to Ron Elving, NPR's Ron Elving, who I believe is on the mall as we listen to Heather Headley. He's in the studio. He's been observing the events in Washington. Ron, your thoughts?
Struck indeed by some of the remarks made not only by the King family members whom we just heard, but also by the former presidents, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, which were rhetorical, of course. They were senior statesmen at a funeral in some respects in terms of their tone, but they were also quite bitingly political. They were talking about gun laws. They were talking about a vote for the District of Columbia. They were talking about stand your ground laws. They were talking about how many African-American men are in jail. They were talking about the issues that face the African-American community and the community as a whole in the United States right now. They were very much on point to the current situation.
President Bill Clinton telling of watching the march in 1963 alone as a little boy in Arkansas. Jimmy Carter told a terrific story about being on the school board in Georgia. He finally got buses for African-American children, but the legislature there had the front fenders painted black. So as he said, not even the school buses were equal. All the speakers very much identifying with the civil rights movement, and all of them, we note, Democratic. From the Democratic Party. Was there controversy over that? Where were the presidents, Bush?
The committee has been under some criticism because the political content of the program was judged to be one-sided, to be too much Democratic. But if you look at the memory of the 1963 event, the people who were there, the people who gathered there, the people who are back, who were there at the time, who are remembering all of that, you are talking about a community here primarily of people who supported the civil rights movement then, supported it today in terms of its inheritors and its inheritance. And that is a group of people that is primarily going to be a Democratic constituency. Jimmy Carter, in fact, in his remarks this afternoon, immediately began by saying, I thank Dr. King for what he did for the vote in America, because without it, none of us Democratic presidents on the stage, myself, Bill Clinton, or Barack Obama, would be here.
Yeah. And Ron, we should say that President Bush, President George W. Bush, still recuperating from that heart procedure that he had, and he had said that he wanted to join but couldn't because of that. But I want to ask you, a lot of mention of Trayvon Martin. Were you surprised by that?
No, there has been a great deal of talk lately about two issues in particular, the Trayvon Martin trial and, of course, the acquittal. And there's been a great deal of talk here today also about the Voting Rights Act decision by the Supreme Court, which was essentially knocking out the essential provision within the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that made it necessary for states, primarily southern states, to bring any vote, or rather any law that would affect the vote, to the Justice Department for pre-clearing before it became law. That was knocked out by the Supreme Court. It's going to make a great deal of difference in terms of Voting Rights Acts, voting rights laws around the country, and already has.
And Ron, we'll ask you to pause as we wait to hear from President Obama, who is stepping up to the podium now.
To the King family, who have sacrificed and inspired so much. To President Clinton, President Carter, Vice President Biden, Jill, fellow Americans. 5 decades ago today, Americans came to this honored place to lay claim to a promise made at our founding. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In 1963, almost 200 years after those words were set to paper, a full century after a great war was fought and emancipation proclaimed, that promise, those truths, remained unmet. And so they came by the thousands from every corner of our country, men and women, young and old, blacks who longed for freedom and whites who could no longer accept freedom for themselves while witnessing the subjugation of others. Across the land, congregations sent them off with food and with prayer. In the middle of the night, entire blocks of Harlem came out to wish them well. With a few dollars they scrimped from their labor, some bought tickets and boarded buses, even if they couldn't always sit where they wanted to sit. Those with less money hitchhiked or walked. They were seamstresses and steel workers, students and teachers, maids and Pullman porters. They shared simple meals and bunked together on floors. And then, on a hot summer day, they assembled here, in our nation's capital, under the shadow of the great emancipator, to offer testimony of injustice, to petition their government for redress, and to awaken America's long slumbering conscience. We rightly and best remember Dr. King's soaring oratory that day, how he gave mighty voice to the quiet hopes of millions, how he offered a salvation path for oppressed and oppressors alike. His words belong to the ages, possessing a power and prophecy unmatched in our time. But we would do well to recall that day itself also belonged to those ordinary people whose names never appeared in the history books, never got on TV. Many had gone to segregated schools and sat at segregated lunch counters. They lived in towns where they couldn't vote, in cities where their votes didn't matter. They were couples in love who couldn't marry, soldiers who fought for freedom abroad that they found denied to them at home. They had seen loved ones beaten and children fire-hosed. And they had every reason to lash out in anger or resign themselves to a bitter fate. And yet, they chose a different path. In the face of hatred, they prayed for their tormentors. In the face of violence, they stood up and sat in with the moral force of nonviolence. Willingly, they went to jail to protest unjust laws, their cells swelling with the sound of freedom songs. A lifetime of indignities had taught them that no man can take away the dignity and grace that God grants us. They had learned through hard experience what Frederick Douglass once taught, that freedom is not given, it must be won through struggle and discipline, persistence and faith. That was the spirit they brought here that day. That was the spirit young people like John Lewis brought to that day. That was the spirit that they carried with them like a torch back to their cities and their neighborhoods, that steady flame of conscience and courage that would sustain them through the campaigns to come, through boycotts and voter registration drives and smaller marches far from the spotlight, through the loss of four little girls in Birmingham and the carnage of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, in the agony of Dallas and California and Memphis, through setbacks and heartbreaks and gnawing doubt, that flame of justice flickered. It never died. And because they kept marching, America changed. Because they marched, the civil rights law was passed. Because they marched, a voting rights law was signed. Because they marched, doors of opportunity and education swung open so their daughters and sons could finally imagine a life for themselves beyond washing somebody else's laundry or shining somebody else's shoes. Because they marched, city councils changed and state legislatures changed and Congress changed and, yes, eventually the White House changed. Because they marched, America became more free and more fair, not just for African Americans, but for women and Latinos, Asians and Native Americans, for Catholics, Jews, and Muslims, for gays, for Americans with disability. America changed for you and for me. And the entire world drew strength from that example. Whether the young people who watched from the other side of an iron curtain and would eventually tear down that wall, or the young people inside South Africa who would eventually end the scourge of apartheid. Those are the victories they won, with iron wills and hope in their hearts. That is the transformation that they wrought with each step of their well-worn shoes. That's the debt that I and millions of Americans owe those maids, those laborers, those porters, those secretaries, folks who could have run a company maybe if they'd ever had a chance, those white students who put themselves in harm's way even though they didn't have to, those Japanese Americans who recalled their own internment, those Jewish Americans who had survived the Holocaust, people who could have given up and given in, but kept on keeping on, knowing that weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. On the battlefield of justice, men and women without rank or wealth or title or fame would liberate us all in ways that our children now take for granted, as people of all colors and creeds live together and learn together and walk together and fight alongside one another and love one another and judge one another by the content of our character in this greatest nation on earth. To dismiss the magnitude of this progress, to suggest, as some sometimes do, that little has changed, that dishonors the courage and the sacrifice of those who paid the price to march in those years. Medgar Evers, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, Martin Luther King Jr., they did not die in vain. Their victory was great. But we would dishonor those heroes as well, to suggest that the work of this nation is somehow complete. The arc of the moral universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. To secure the gains this country has made requires constant vigilance, not complacency. Whether by challenging those who erect new barriers to the vote, or ensuring that the scales of justice work equally for all, and the criminal justice system is not simply a pipeline from underfunded schools to overcrowded jails, it requires vigilance. And we'll suffer the occasional setback. But we will win these fights. This country has changed too much. People of goodwill, regardless of party, are too plentiful for those with ill will to change history's currents. In some ways, though, the securing of civil rights, voting rights, the eradication of legalized discrimination, the very significance of these victories may have obscured a second goal of the march. For the men and women who gathered 50 years ago were not there in search of some abstract idea. They were there seeking jobs as well as justice. Not just the absence of oppression, but the presence of economic opportunity. For what does it profit a man, Dr. King would ask, to sit at an integrated lunch counter if he can't afford the meal? This idea that one's liberty is linked to one's livelihood, that the pursuit of happiness requires the dignity of work, the skills to find work, decent pay, some measure of material security. This idea was not new. Lincoln himself understood the Declaration of Independence in such terms, as a promise that in due time the weights should be lifted from the shoulders of all men and that all should have an equal chance. And Dr. King explained that the goals of African Americans were identical to working people of all races. Decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, old age security, health and welfare measures, conditions in which families can grow, have education for their children, and respect in the community. What King was describing has been the dream of every American. It's what's lured for centuries new arrivals to our shores. And it's along this second dimension of economic opportunity, the chance through honest toil to advance one's station in life, where the goals of 50 years ago have fallen most short. Yes, there have been examples of success within Black America that would have been unimaginable a half century ago. But as has already been noted, Black unemployment has remained almost twice as high as white employment. Latino unemployment close behind. The gap in wealth between races has not lessened, it's grown. And as President Clinton indicated, the position of all working Americans, regardless of color, has eroded, making the dream Dr. King described even more elusive. For over a decade, working Americans of all races have seen their wages and income stagnate, even as corporate profits soar, even as the pay of a fortunate few explodes. Inequality has steadily risen over the decades. Upward mobility has become harder. In too many communities across this country, in cities and suburbs and rural hamlets, the shadow of poverty casts a pall over our youth, their lives a fortress of substandard schools and diminished prospects, inadequate health care, and perennial violence. And so, as we mark this anniversary, we must remind ourselves that the measure of progress for those who marched 50 years ago was not merely how many blacks could join the ranks of millionaires. It was whether this country would admit all people who are willing to work hard, regardless of race, into the ranks of a middle-class life. The test was not, and never has been, whether the doors of opportunity are cracked a bit wider for a few. This is whether our economic system provides a fair shot for the many, for the black custodian and the white steelworker, the immigrant dishwasher, and the Native American veteran. To win that battle, to answer that call, this remains our great unfinished business. We shouldn't fool ourselves. The task will not be easy. Since 1963, the economy's changed. The twin forces of technology and global competition have subtracted those jobs that once provided a foothold into the middle class, reduced the bargaining power of American workers. And our politics has suffered. Entrenched interests, those who benefit from an unjust status quo, resisted any government efforts to give working families a fair deal, marshaling an army of lobbyists and opinion makers to argue that minimum wage increases or stronger labor laws or taxes on the wealthy who could afford it just to fund crumbling schools, that all these things violated sound economic principles. We'd be told that growing inequality was a price for a growing economy, a measure of a free market, that greed was good and compassion ineffective, and those without jobs or health care had only themselves to blame. And then there were those elected officials who found it useful to practice the old politics of division, doing their best to convince middle-class Americans of a great untruth, that government was somehow itself to blame for their growing economic insecurity, that distant bureaucrats were taking their hard-earned dollars to benefit the welfare cheat or the illegal immigrant. And then, if we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that during the course of 50 years, there were times when some of us claiming to push for change lost our way. The anguish of assassinations set off self-defeating riots. Legitimate grievances against police brutality tipped into excuse-making for criminal behavior. Racial politics could cut both ways, as the transformative message of unity and brotherhood was drowned out by the language of recrimination. And what had once been a call for equality of opportunity, the chance for all Americans to work hard and get ahead, was too often framed as a mere desire for government support, as if we had no agency in our own liberation, as if poverty was an excuse for not raising your child, and the bigotry of others was reason to give up on yourself. All of that history is how progress stalled. That's how hope was diverted. That's how our country remained divided. But the good news is, just as was true in 1963, we now have a choice. We can continue down our current path, in which the gears of this great democracy grind to a halt and our children accept a life of lower expectations, where politics is a zero-sum game, where few do very well while struggling families of every race fight over a shrinking economic pie. That's one path. Or we can have the courage to change. The March on Washington teaches us that we are not trapped by the mistakes of history, that we are masters of our fate. But it also teaches us that the promise of this nation will only be kept when we work together. We'll have to reignite the embers of empathy and fellow feeling, the coalition of conscience that found expression in this place 50 years ago. And I believe that spirit is there, that truth force inside each of us. I see it when a white mother recognizes her own daughter in the face of a poor black child. I see it when the black youth thinks of his own grandfather in the dignified steps of an elderly white man. It's there when the native born recognizing that striving spirit of the new immigrant. When the interracial couple connects the pain of a gay couple who are discriminated against and understands it as their own. That's where courage comes from. When we turn not from each other or on each other, but towards one another, and we find that we do not walk alone. That's where courage comes from. And with that courage, we can stand together for good jobs and just wages. With that courage, we can stand together for the right to health care in the richest nation on earth for every person. With that courage, we can stand together for the right of every child from the corners of Anacostia to the hills of Appalachia to get an education that stirs the mind and captures the spirit and prepares them for the world that awaits them. With that courage, we can feed the hungry and house the homeless and transform bleak wastelands of poverty into fields of commerce and promise. America, I know the road will be long, but I know we can get there. Yes, we will stumble, but I know we'll get back up. That's how a movement happens. That's how history bends. That's how when somebody is faint of heart, somebody else brings them along and says, come on, we're marching. There's a reason why so many who marched that day and in the days to come were young. For the young are unconstrained by habits of fear, unconstrained by the conventions of what is. They dare to dream differently, to imagine something better. And I am convinced that same imagination, the same hunger of purpose, stirs in this generation. We might not face the same dangers of 1963, but the fierce urgency of now remains. We may never duplicate the swelling crowds and dazzling procession of that day so long ago. No one can match King's brilliance, but the same flame that lit the heart of all who are willing to take a first step for justice, I know that flame remains. That tireless teacher who gets to class early and stays late and dips into her own pocket to buy supplies because she believes that every child is her charge, she's marching. That successful businessman who doesn't have to but pays his workers a fair wage and then offers a shot to a man, maybe an ex-con, who's down on his luck, he's marching. The mother who pours her love into her daughter so that she grows up with the confidence to walk through the same doors as anybody's son, she's marching. The father who realizes the most important job he'll ever have is raising his boy right, even if he didn't have a father, especially if he didn't have a father at home, he's marching. The battle-scarred veterans who devote themselves not only to helping their fellow warriors stand again and walk again and run again, but to keep serving their country when they come home. They are marching. Everyone who realizes what those glorious patriots knew on that day, that change does not come from Washington, but to Washington. The change has always been built on our willingness, we, the people, to take on the mantle of citizenship. You are marching. And that's the lesson of our past. That's the promise of tomorrow. That in the face of impossible odds, people who love their country can change it. That when millions of Americans of every race and every region, every faith and every station can join together in a spirit of brotherhood, then those mountains will be made low, and those rough places will be made plain, and those crooked places, they straighten out towards grace. And we will vindicate the faith of those who sacrifice so much and live up to the true meaning of our creed as one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. I'm Robin Young along with Jeremy Hobson, and we just heard the keynote speech from Barack Obama, the first black president of the United States. And we want to take a second and go right now to the mall where thousands have gathered. NPR's Brian Naylor is there, NPR's Washington correspondent Brian Naylor. Brian, the crowd looks mixed and huge. Tell us what's going on there.
Hi, Robin. Yeah, the crowd has been actually building all day. The last we heard, there are still people who are trying to get in, and I hope they at least were able to hear these last several speeches, because they were pretty powerful, including from President Obama, who just kind of wrapped up the day's events here. It's been maybe not as a big a crowd as occurred 50 years ago, but there was still a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of folks hoping to hear. I think what they heard today, there was a lot of talk about the dream did not die 50 years ago, but that the work remains that work remains to be done, and they've heard that from speaker after speaker, including the president himself.
We're watching the president greet members of the King family, President Clinton, former presidents Clinton and Carter, also on the podium, Oprah, President Obama speaking about how the version of a march today is offering a job to a vet, raising a daughter as you would a son, you know, a father realizing his most important job was to raise a son right. Those people marching, President Obama said. How was it received?
I think there was a lot of applause. We're a little bit where I am, a little bit cordoned off from the crowd. We heard some cheers in the background. I think it's interesting. The president talked a lot about race, but he also talked a lot about economic inequality and how the message 50 years ago, this was originally the March on Washington for jobs and he was talking about that today, yeah, about the lack, the wealth inequality of the distribution of wealth and the need to continue to work on that.
He said it was not just a demand for the absence of oppression, but the presence of economic opportunity.
Yeah, and let's bring in Peniel Joseph, who's here with us in the studio, a founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and a professor of history at Tufts University. A lot there about income inequality. Did that surprise you?
Well, no, I don't think it surprised me. I think the speech was powerful. I mean, I think the themes outlined in the speech, economic inequality, there's a point where he does definitely rhapsodize about that. He tries to counterbalance by talking about poverty and saying, you know, you've got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which he often does, especially to African-American audiences. But it was a very knowing speech in the sense that he realizes that this Congress will not pass any major legislation. I think part of this speech was disappointing in the sense of not talking about any public policy proposals for what the speech outlines.
Which Bill Clinton did in his speech.
Absolutely. So the President of the United States, this would have been a great time to make some kind of statement about what kind of vision of America he sees in the future. You know, like, I have a dream, even if I think the Congress isn't going to pass this, what could be done?
Robin, he said, the arc of moral victory may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. Probably a line that will be remembered from this speech by President Obama.
And paraphrasing Martin Luther King there, as he did. Speaking of the speeches of presidents, current and former, let's bring in Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, we just heard Peniel say he was a little bit disappointed in some of President Obama's speech, that he didn't speak more about policy. You have listened to so many speeches. How would you characterize this one?
Well, look, that's the ongoing struggle of this president dealing with a Congress which resists passing a lot of his legislation. And that's a fair criticism. And it's a criticism I'm sure we'll hear and we've heard about President Obama. That said, I think he, you know, did a good job of linking both the march and Martin Luther's King's speech, which was sprinkled throughout his own oratory, to the big issues of the day, including immigration and including economic inequality. And I think, you know, in some sense, he's using that to try to build energy and interest in these issues that will face Congress when it returns in a few weeks.
We're reminded that 50 years ago, the organizers of the March on Washington were accused of softening their own rhetoric, Peniel, and they felt that they had a strategy that they had to carry out. This is not new.
Yeah, they wanted to support the president's civil rights bill. So even somebody like John Lewis, his speech was, it had to be edited. And part of that was people were offended by how militant and strident he talked about transforming democracy in the South and going for racial justice. So part of it is that you have to know who your audience is. But as president of the United States, you have the right to propose major public policy, mm-hmm, even if the Congress is not going to pass it. And it would have been wonderful if I think the speech was pitch perfect, but there's a few paragraphs missing about policy, especially for poor people, and policy for African Americans, Latinos, immigration. Would have been great if he said, I have a dream, pass this immigration bill, pass a jobs bill, you know, for Martin Luther King Jr. Let's do it for this country.
I want to bring in Linda Wertheimer, NPR's senior national correspondent, who was there during the original march in 1963. Linda, your thoughts on what you saw today?
Well, I think that the extraordinary memories that everybody has of the march 50 years ago were the speech of Dr. King. And although the president, I think, is a fine orator, he doesn't quite reach to the levels that Dr. King did. But then, of course, no one does. And I think that I think that watching this is a wonderful tribute to Dr. King and to what happened there. But when I think about that day, you know, I don't think about the speeches. I know that I heard Dr. King speak. I can remember the sort of rumbling in the background from the loudspeakers, but that was not what struck me about the speech. What struck me was the extraordinary expression of unity, I think, or inspiration that everyone took from the crowd, from so many, many people being there. And the sense that if so many people could be gathered in one place at one time with one thought in their minds, that would somehow turn the country.
Linda,
and
do you think that the president's speech is the one that will be remembered from today's event, or was there one that struck you more than what President Obama said?
You know, I would the only person that I would place. I think that the president's speeches, all three president's speeches, were quite wonderful, and I thought John Lewis's speech was quite wonderful.
There was a line from John Lewis that I thought was just exquisite. He was talking about what Martin Luther King told him and taught him, and again, he's the only surviving voice from the speakers from 1963, and he said one of the things he was taught by Martin Luther King was, even in those who were violent or violent towards us, there was a spark of the divine. Many of his lines jumped out, but that stayed with me. More about what stayed with you, Linda.
Well, what stayed with me, you mean from today?
Mm-hmm.
I noticed President Obama sort of, I don't know, I'm thinking it's the prayer of St. Francis when he says, in the face of hatred, they prayed for their tormentors.
Right.
When he talked about dismissing the magnitude of the progress the country's made dishonors the sacrifice of those who were there at the march. But that to suggest that the work is done would dishonor them also. I thought it was a very good speech. And you know, of course, everybody likes the kind of thundering rhetoric that you get at the end of a speech like this. And I thought the last part of his speech was really quite good. I thought I liked it when President Clinton got a little bit was talking a little bit more sharply about the Congress and about the difficulty of getting anything done in this modern politics, which is so in such disarray and so polarized. Mm-hmm. I think they raised all of the things that you would imagine these Democratic presidents would raise, but again, you know, I think just the idea that so many people have so many memories of a day like that and an event like that 50 years ago and then forward 50 years, that is the thing that I think is the memory that we'll all take away from this day.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what President Obama just said.
Because they marched, America became more free and more fair, not just for African Americans, but for women and Latinos, Asians and Native Americans, for Catholics, Jews, and Muslims, for gays, for Americans with disabilities. America changed for you and for me. And the entire world drew strength from that example. Whether the young people who watched from the other side of an iron curtain and would eventually tear down that wall, or the young people inside South Africa who would eventually end the scourge of apartheid. Those are the victories they won. with iron wills and hope in their hearts. That is the transformation that they wrought with each step of their well-worn shoes. That's the debt that I and millions of Americans owe those maids, those laborers, those porters, those secretaries, folks who could have run a company maybe if they'd ever had a chance, those white students who put themselves in harm's way even though they didn't have to, those Japanese Americans who recalled their own internment, those Jewish Americans who had survived the Holocaust, people who could have given up and given in, but kept on keeping on, knowing that weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning.
Well, Robin, this speech is being watched today by many people, like Linda Wertheimer, who saw the original speech, but also by a lot of people who did not and are very young right now. Still, 15-year-old Mary Pat Hector joins us from Atlanta. She's the youth director of the National Action Network. And Mary Pat Hector, what did you make of what you heard today?
Well, you know, I've heard several people say that, well, one person say that they weren't a fan of some of the things that President Barack Obama said, and if they think that this speech is going to go down through history, and I really do believe so. One, because who would think 50 years later after, you know, Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech that the president of the United States, an African-American man, would be giving a speech. And I think that that's why it's going to go out through history. And I think that this speech really is going to touch a lot of young people. He talked about the hundreds of kids that died and rioted in apartheid and the victories that they've won. And I couldn't help but to think about us. You know, what are we going to do as young people? And I think that President Barack Obama might have sparked some things in so many different young people today.
Well, and that's fascinating. And you've already been sparked because you marched on Saturday and the march then. What do you hope that young people do because of what they heard today? He talked about the fact that the dream might come to fruition if a young black youth thinks of his own father in the steps of an elderly white man. In other words, doesn't see the white but sees the elderly and cares for him. When people see discrimination against a gay couple and see it as their own discrimination, what are you hoping young people take from this?
Well, one, I just hope that young people actually have a plan. I mean, you know, President Barack Obama talked about the gays, you know, people looking past color and looking past relationships and looking past, you know, who loves who. And I think that young people get that now. I think that now's the time in the world where we are starting to become more comfortable with our sexuality and accepting people who like the same gender and accepting people from different races, colors, and cultures. But what are we going to do to make sure that we're not fighting for the same things now or marching for the same things in 50 years when my grandchildren are going to march at the 100th anniversary of the March on Washington? And so I think that young people need to listen to what was said on the microphone and on the stage today and make a plan, come up with a youth agenda so we make sure that we're not marching for the same things in 50 years.
Martin Luther King's youngest daughter spoke, and she talked about how there was more today about standing your ground than finding common ground. Your thoughts about how much Trayvon Martin was mentioned?
You know, Trayvon Martin really sparked a movement when it comes to a lot of different young people and young people standing up. And I think that the Trayvon Martin case, I believe, touched a lot, you know, being on Instagram. The Trayvon Martin case woke up a lot of people, and definitely young people. And I really do appreciate Bernice King for that, you know, about the stand your ground gun laws. And President Barack Obama even talked about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But how can young people live life afraid to walk down the streets, definitely in Chicago, where Barack Obama's from, if something like Stand Your Ground is still around?
15-year-old Mary Pat Hector, the youth director of the National Action Network, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I want to go back to Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. What do you make of what we just heard from a young activist, and how important are young people in carrying forward the dream of Martin Luther King?
Absolutely essential. I mean, one of the remarkable things about the civil rights movement is its ability to inspire younger African Americans and white Americans at the time to take what was very dangerous steps. The March on Washington was part of this, but so was confronting Southern police who were willing to attack marchers and protesters. And that is the kind of courage that we hope for. And I think, you know, President Obama said something important. It's not just remembering the unfulfilled part of the agenda, but it's remembering what we accomplished, how much transformation that they wrought, he said. In 1963, King made that speech. Congress was broken then, and they were just trying to pass a bill that would achieve racial desegregation in public accommodations. Today, we hear from an African-American president who's calling in some ways for a much broader agenda to deal with inequality, immigration, gay rights. And I think there's some inspiration you can take from how far we've moved, and I think that was an important part of his message.
Yeah, Princeton's Julian Zelitz are there, and we also have Peniel Joseph from Tufts in the studio with us. And I'm struck at how Barack Obama often in these major speeches becomes something of a father-in-chief. He's not afraid to call out his own community, and he did in this speech in a bit. He pointed out when some in the movement might have lost their way. He said they let grievances about real police brutality tip into excuses for criminal behavior. Peniel, your thoughts on that line making its way into a speech today?
Well, I think the president has always done that. He's, especially to African-American audiences, talked about pulling yourself up by the bootstrap, no excuses. I think that part of that is something that goes back in our history. Jesse Jackson used to do the same thing. But certainly the idea of having no excuses is important. But institutional racism still exists. The president's speech has outlined this. His attorney general has admitted it. And the only thing that can replace that is policy. So the reason why we celebrate the March on Washington is because of the extraordinary policy changes that were effected in 64 and 65. So we're hopeful that on the 50th anniversary, looking forward, we need new transformative policy that's not just coming from the Congress, but that's coming from the executive office.
This is something that we heard from a young activist that we spoke with who said that he wanted President Obama to sign an executive order raising the minimum wage, which is, I saw a sign on the mall by somebody who was leaning up against the fence along the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial that said something about the minimum wage.
Absolutely. An executive order would have been tremendous right now. He did one after the shooting in Sandy Hook. He did one after he said he was going to do some for the environment. It would have been tremendous to have an executive order in terms of the minimum wage or economic opportunity. Policy is what we need right now in our own time.
Well, we have NPR's Rona Elving also observing this day with us, a senior Washington editor there in Washington. Your thoughts, Ron, on how the president did or did not raise certain issues? I'm seeing tweets fly by that say, I wish he had mentioned Trayvon Martin by name. Others might think that wouldn't be appropriate for today. Your thoughts on what you heard?
Trayvon Martin was brought up by many speakers during the course of the day. The president was probably never going to be one of them. We never got prepared remarks from the White House on what the president was going to say, and I suspect that it may have been, to some degree, a late edit. He might have been working on it right up to the time of the ceremony. And it also seems to have been a fairly personal Professor Obama effort, where he was lecturing at times. He was telling people, both white and black, what their part of the struggle going forward should be. He sounded a little bit like a history professor at times, a law professor at times. And then at the end, as Linda's observed, he became Reverend Obama, and he gave us a little bit more of the spirit of the black church that he sometimes summons up in his speeches. One of the things that I think a lot of people probably will want to have heard, besides references to racial justice cases like Trayvon Martin, would be more about the unemployment question. At the time in 1963 that Martin Luther King made his speech, the unemployment rate among African Americans was, officially at least, about 11%. It's now over 14%. And among white people at the time, it was at least officially about 5%, and it's now up closer to 6.5%. Unemployment is a bigger problem in America today than it was 50 years ago.
Ron, I've seen some say that he managed to broaden out the struggle for civil rights, the modern struggle for civil rights, from just African Americans to a fight that everyone, every American is engaged in. Do you think he did that? Did he succeed at doing that?
This is one of the great quotes that comes actually from Martin Luther King Sr. that his son's great struggle was not just to liberate black people, but to liberate all people. And this is something that I think President Obama has tried to pick up on. Certainly in just the last year or so, he has broadened his own explicit talk of liberation to the gay marriage or the marriage equality movement, made that part of his second campaign for president. And that was there in his speech today, if briefly. And he has tried to capture some of Dr. King's spirit in terms of broadening the question of equality.
Yeah. NPR's Ron Elving. Julian Zelitzer there at Princeton. What do you make of the makeup of the audience? The people on the mall seem much more mixed than 50 years ago.
Well, it seemed like that from the images. I don't know.
Right.
But I assume to some extent that's the case. And that is part of the success of the civil rights movement. It has normalized the cause of civil rights and the basic issue, which in 1963 was still radical for many Americans. The ideas of desegregation and voting rights for African Americans were still, you know, seen as not mainstream, and today they are. Today we're just pushing for much broader issues of economic justice. So if that's the case, and I don't know if that's true, it wouldn't surprise me. It is important to remember in 63, unions were part of the march, and it wasn't just African Americans who were there. White unionists were there as well. So there was a mix. But that is the progress we hope has been accomplished. And my guess is that is true about what we saw in the mall today.
The estimates of about 75,000 to 95,000 white Americans joined African Americans in 1963. Peniel, you were going to jump in?
Yeah, I think what's really, we have to remember 50 years later, what's been normalized is a narrative of success about the civil rights movement that focuses too much on African Americans who are in high positions of power like President Obama. So what King really wanted to talk about all these years ago was poverty and the least of these, right? People who were in prison, who were on welfare. And by that standard, we haven't had as much success as we celebrate 50 years later. So if we look at Oprah Winfrey and Bill Cosby and Barack Obama, things are fine. But if we look at the majority of African Americans, how much money do they make? They live below the poverty line, about 28%. Another 27% make below $35,000 a year. 841,000 black men in prison. These are extraordinary signs of racial crisis and not racial progress. President alluded to that, but we need policy to fix that.
Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and president of history at Tufts University. We were also joined today by Linda Wertheimer, NPR's senior national correspondent, who was there in 1963 at the march. We were also joined by Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, and of course, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
And we want to thank you all. And we want to leave with some sounds from 50 years ago and the Reverend Martin Luther King.
Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963. His speech and that march was commemorated today, and so was his call for freedom ringing. Bells were ringing in Stone Mountain, Georgia, and other places that he mentioned in that speech, and across the country at 3 p.m. East Coast time today, a response to his call 50 years ago.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This has been special coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington from NPR and WBUR Boston.